Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. I was really lucky at the beginning of this summer to travel to a number of Greek islands. And God, the water there is absolutely electric. You can see why it is the place of mythology, such incredible landscape. And then the water is just unlike anything I've ever had the chance to see. And I loved hearing all the different mythology about Athena and Zeus and so on. And there was one story that really stuck with me. It was the story of the Amazons who lived in Themyscira, and they were the most fierce female warriors ascended from Ares, the god of war. And it just reminded me of the story that we have of Tir na n'Amon. This land, the Amazons had no men in their culture, and the same in Tir na n'Amon. There was no men, but the neighboring village would supply mortal men to provide the Amazons and Tir na n'Amon with women. That sort of idea of a magical, mystical place where no men exist was a really international idea of a good thing. And certainly if we think about the male island of politics, having an all-island political landscape could be very interesting. But the reason I'm telling you this is because this actually does exist in nature, in a rather unusual species called the Amazon Molly. And on this week's program, we're going to be hearing about the Amazon Molly and how it's managed to survive for 100,000 years without any males at all. It should not be possible, and yet it is. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by a regular Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway, and regularly attending, but irregular in nature, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCT. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Shane, has to do with measles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this will come as no surprise to many listeners. Measles cases in the United States have reached a 34-year high. So what this means is that the United States is on track to lose its, quote, measles elimination status. And this is something that the World Health Organization, that the United States has recently left, characterizes as basically the kind of the difference between measles being endemic or not. In other words, is it just spreading of its own accord, or are there isolated cases that a system can track and trace? People will remember this sort of language from the COVID days. So in 2026, thus far, there have been 2,295 cases, which is already more than all of 2025. There are outbreaks in South Carolina, a particularly virulent one there, and there's one brewing in Utah. Now, just so listeners are clear and that we don't kind of end up with a pylon for our good friends in the United States. Hello, Jessamine. Many EU countries have already lost their measles elimination status, most notably France and Germany, which I would always think of as sort of sensible countries, but they do have a large amount of vaccine skepticism in those countries. Italy and Poland as well. Ireland.
I was living in France during COVID, and there was a lot of anti-vax stuff, even in the peak of it.
Yeah, so I do think it's important when we talk about these things to not just assume that all of these sort of anti-science, anti-vax threads are particular to the United States. They exist in most Western countries. Ireland does have a measles elimination status. It's had it since 2017, much later than many other countries, but we still have it. And of course, the sort of the status of any country is really determined by how many people or what percentage of people have received the measles, mumps and rubella, the MMR vaccine. Measles is incredibly virulent. Its reproduction number is estimated to be between 12 and 18, which basically means if you have the measles and you are around somebody who hasn't been vaccinated, the likelihood of them catching it from you is almost certain. And it is a nasty disease. Before vaccines were introduced in the 60s, in the United States alone, 500,000 people a year contracted measles, and they were predominantly children, and many of them would have had life-altering consequences as a result. So it's a nasty, nasty disease. And the introduction of a vaccine was seen as something that offered us a way out of this disease. If you catch it, it's a virus. There's virtually nothing you can do once you have it. Those who do get it in the United States at the moment are almost exclusively those who haven't been vaccinated. But yeah. What's interesting is that it's not just children that are getting it. It's people of all ages that are getting it. So we're seeing now the kind of the cohort of people in that society that are not vaccinated from young to old, and they're catching it.
Yeah, because the chances of actually meeting someone who had measles was so low that we had that sort of herd immunity, that the few people who weren't vaccinated were okay. But now, you get to a level where the likelihood of meeting someone with measles is much higher. And so that's the problem. So vaccinate your children, please, people. Jess, our second story has to do with an exoplanet. And we've talked about exoplanets many times on this program. And we discover an exoplanet here, and we discover a planet there, and we look under the rug and more exoplanets. What's interesting about this story?
Yeah, I love hearing exoplanet stories as well. But I always find it a little bit frustrating because often it's like, oh, new exoplanet found. And it's like, great, tell me more about it. It's 50 times the mass of Jupiter and it orbits like a foot away from its star. And I'm like, that's not a planet that I foresee myself or something like me living on particularly.
Yeah.
It is interesting. But what's really cool about this exoplanet that's just been discovered by a team at Harvard is that not only is it a rocky planet, it's orbiting a red dwarf, and it's in the habitable zone of that red dwarf. So, you know, within the type of planetary orbit that we find ourselves in. And what's really cool about it is that it seems to have an atmosphere. The existence of rocky planets, and indeed those with atmospheres, is very likely, but they're quite hard to detect. Like, it is much easier to detect these kind of like mega gas giants that are very close to the star that they orbit. They're more luminous. They're more likely to block out some of their own star's light as they pass across it. Finding these smaller rocky planets is really difficult. And I would have said that they're just little cuties. But if we're trying to find them and trying to figure out whether they have an atmosphere or not, that's, again, like an order of magnitude more difficult. But what this team has found is not only that this, it's about a 5 times the mass of Earth planet that's orbiting a red dwarf. So it would be in the 10 to sort of 60% mass of the sun. For the star itself. And what they can actually see is that there's helium escaping from the planet. So they were able to use like spectrophotometry to see that there are signatures of helium that's coming off the planet, which implies not only that there's some sort of helium in the atmosphere on that planet, but also that there's probably heavier gases that are trapped further down. Helium, obviously, we know from balloons, is a very light gas. So yeah. It's maybe not surprising that this is sort of the first signature of an atmosphere on this planet. But yeah, just very exciting to see a planet that's so much more like ours in this intensifying hunt for exoplanets.
Can we see grass on this planet?
Not yet. But if we think about those elements for life, right, not to make everything about us, but as we look for other planets that might host something that looks more like us than what we found in the universe so far, like a rocky planet, a planet with an atmosphere, the next steps will be to look for traces of more complicated molecules that might be in the atmosphere. And these red dwarf stars, like the one that this planet, it's the planet's name is LHS1140b. These red dwarf stars that it orbits are the most common type of star in the Milky Way. So there's a potential to find a lot more planets like this, especially as red dwarf stars are dimmer than our own star. So the possibility to see these kind of faint traces of like a rocky planet and then a rocky planet with an atmosphere would be much more likely.
Okay. And just to be clear, we wouldn't ever be able to actually see grass. Like if we had a really, really, really good telescope, we still wouldn't be able to see grass on a planet like this, right? Just because of the sort of noise in between.
Yeah, there's.
I don't know why I'm focusing on grass, but I'm just looking at grass at the moment.
I'm surprised you're not interested in the fact that any alien there would have a squeaky voice because of all the helium.
Yeah.
Well, not if they live on the surface, Shane.
That's like one of those RTE characters that, you know, from when we all used to watch TV as children before
more study needed to look for the squeaky voices.
Yeah. Our third story, Shane, has to do with AI. And we specifically are not talking about the story that I covered on Bobby Kerr yesterday of AI escaping and attacking Hugging Face. It's a very interesting story, but I guess it's been covered by everybody else. This is a different story.
Yeah, this is one that was picked up from a very random conference, like for people working in designing interactive systems. And it's about an AI ghost that can comfort mourners on a loss of a loved one. So effectively, what the people in Boulder, Colorado have done here is they've used ChatGPT to basically kind of feed in information about a loved one. And then the participant goes on, and with an intermediary there, they interact with the avatar or the AI ghost of the person who's died. So imagine I lost a loved one and I had some unresolved questions for them. I could work with this team, give them information about the loved one, and then I'd be able to ask it questions. And that's what
what sort of questions? Like, where did you leave the keys?
Well, actually, that's very interesting, because they looked at how the group evaluated the reincarnation, but also the representation of the loved one. And what they found was people weren't so bothered about facts, but more about affect. But also, I think that the
participants... So in other words, they didn't really care whether or not, if you asked a ghost AI a question like, tell me about my father, and he was a Scottish man, but he was actually French. But they did care if he looked like him.
Or sounded like them, or kind of it felt right. So I have come across so many bonkers stories on AI over the years, but this must be one of the most unethical research studies I've ever come across. 16 volunteers found through social media who were invited to take part in this study. The one really positive thing about it is that whilst people weren't damning, they were very realistic of how dangerous this could be, that you could become very, very attached to this AI ghost. They realized that.
I've heard this argument before. We actually interviewed a guy on the show who invented an AI called Dadbot, so we could have conversations with his father. And there were a lot of people who commented at the time saying, you know, there's no closure here and he has to say goodbye and, you know, it's not natural. And I guess a lot of the stuff that we live with today is not natural. And while, you know, the idea of an AI ghost of your father might be ridiculous, but if they do a really, really good job, you know, being able to have that presence there when you feel sad and lonely and feel like that is, you know, that embodies him mostly in some way, I don't think we yet actually know what evils that might do, because everyone is afraid of change. But I don't know. We obviously haven't had AI ghosts around long enough to be able to know the effect of an AI ghost long-term relationship. But I see, you know, why people would have a problem with it. But I also see, you know, Japanese people feeling, you know, having this huge loneliness epidemic, inventing all sorts of robots to try and solve this problem. Saying is, it may take a total mind shift, but we don't know the negative effects, although we do know it could.
No, that's true. And I wondered when the photograph was first invented, and somebody had died and you could see the loved one after they died, how that was viewed. But I do think that...
You just hate AI.
I'm very skeptical of it, as you know. But I also think it's interesting that people didn't realize the circular nature of this. So the individual fed in all of the information that as they saw it about their loved one.
Yeah.
Then effectively that was being fed back to them. I just felt like if you want to do this sort of thing, talk to other people who knew the loved one.
Maybe that's a good idea. But then you might get a version of your father that you didn't actually know. You know, maybe, you know, your father had a second family or something. You know, like there is dangers there for sure. Really interesting.
Would you take part in this?
I think my dad would not like that. My mom would love it. I think I'd do it for my mom. My dad would be like, nah, leave me. Mom just wants to live forever. My mom's mad. She wants to live forever. All right. Our final story has to do with some really interesting findings regarding our very own galaxy, the Milky Way, Jess.
That's right. Tricky topics on Earth. Let's go back to space. This is a new study that just came out of Durham University about the Milky Way and the fact that about 10 billion years ago, we think that it flipped on its side as a result of a head-on collision with another galaxy. Now, to me, this is both really cool to think about, but it's kind of a detective story almost, because these researchers were looking at stars in the Milky Way. And, you know, the Milky Way is kind of this flat disk, the galaxy that we're in. We can kind of see the band of it across the sky because we're sitting at a point in the disk. But it also has this halo of stars that go all around it in kind of a sphere. And what the researchers noticed and were puzzled by is the fact that the stars in the halo of the Milky Way were orbiting the center much more slowly than stars in the disk. So stars in the disk were going about 10 times faster as they went around the center of the Milky Way compared to these ones in the sort of spherical halo. And that didn't really make a lot of sense unless you thought about some other set of stars coming in and interacting with the Milky Way at some point in the past. And so this team from Durham did a bunch of simulations to find that actually, if you had a Milky Way-like galaxy and you had another much smaller galaxy kind of come in a head-on collision and effectively over millions of years get like absorbed into it gravitationally, you could end up with a situation like this, where you have this sort of cloud of slower stars orbiting around the center of this sort of disk of much faster moving stars. But one of the things that this would mean is that the entire disk would sort of flip onto its side by about 90 degrees. So go from lying flat to like standing straight up in space, which is kind of crazy to think about. And it also probably contributed to creating the like the bulge in the middle of the Milky Way, which we can see, you know, if you ever have been somewhere really, really dark and you can see the shape of the galaxy in the sky at night, which is very cool.
Wait. Mm-hmm. Hang on a second.
Yeah.
You can't have a standing straight up in space. Space is 360 degrees.
Mm-hmm. But it's rotating.
But even space is rotating. You can't say it's standing up because every way is up and every way is down.
Think of it like you're in a swimming pool. You know, you can have something that's oriented horizontally. You can have something that's oriented vertically. Neither one is standing, I suppose, technically, but they're both floating at different angles with respect to each other. Okay. And what I think is cool, too, you know, this is sort of a detective story about something that happened to the Milky Way in the past. But there are actually lots of examples of galaxies that are experiencing mergers right now. So you can look up like the Antennae galaxies, the Mice galaxies, the Butterfly galaxies. And they're all these sort of mid-merger processes where you can clearly see two galaxies in the middle of like ripping into each other and forming eventually a new galaxy. Which I think is really cool. But one of the other great things about this story is that the slow moving stars that are in our galaxy, they have this sort of sausage shaped orbit. And so the team at Durham have named the historical galaxy that they think we collided with the Gaia sausage. So the Gaia sausage underwent a collision with our Milky Way galaxy. And that has resulted in the galaxy we know and love today.
There's like 20 jokes that have gone through my head and none of them are appropriate. So I'll just say that's a very interesting story, Jessamine.
It sure is.
Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, thank you very much.
Yes, you're welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, not to state the blindingly obvious, but sexual reproduction is quite important to us humans. As well as being our method of propagating the species, it also frames our relationships, our culture, our history, music, dance, everything. But is it strictly necessary? Not, it would seem, for the Amazon Molly. It's a freshwater fish that hasn't reproduced in this way for 100,000 years, and yet they're somehow thriving. How? Well, Ed Reismeyer is CEO, bioinformatician in the chair of animal systems genomics at Ludwig Maximilians Universität München. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Ed.
Thank you for having me.
I might just call you Ed from now on, if that's okay.
Sure, that's great.
So tell me about this incredible fish, the Amazon Molly.
Sure. So to start off, if it's okay, I'd like to just talk a little bit about sexual reproduction and why it is important. So if you think about it, on one level, sexual reproduction seems like a very complicated way to reproduce and to make new generations. And that's because there are two big problems. First of all, you have to find a mate, and you have to find a mate that is of the right age, the right sex, and in a place that you have a chance of bumping into them. And then beyond that, there's also the issue of there's often a lopsided investment in reproduction between the two sexes in a species. So if you think about mammals, for instance, the female has to carry around a fetus for a while, and then even after birth has to breastfeed it. Whereas if you can imagine a situation in which there were no males, so if females could just make copies of themselves, then you could think of it as having the opportunity to create twice as many offspring every generation. So what is the advantage to it? And why is it that everything, whether you're talking about single-celled amoeba or mushrooms or plants, or of course animals, not just usually is able to sexually reproduce in some way, but actually almost always engages in sexual reproduction? And the answer that biologists have come up with to this is that what happens during sexual reproduction is genes get mixed up between the mother and the father. And this is really important because it means that in one individual, perhaps that individual has some mutations that are very helpful to it, but some other mutations that are very not helpful to it. The shuffling of genes that happens during sexual reproduction allows the good ones and the bad ones to be separated from each other so that natural selection can act differently on the good ones and the bad ones. And there is a concept called Muller's ratchet, which predicts that because under asexual reproduction, no offspring can have fewer mutations than its parent, it ought to cause a species to go extinct eventually.
Right. So what you're saying is when you have a male and a female, when they reproduce sexually, they swap around the mutations and it's kind of like shuffling a deck of cards every time. And so you get a different deck for a different child. And so if there is a fatal mutation, it's carried in the gene line, for example, that could theoretically just sort of get shuffled out. But in the case of asexual reproduction, where you're essentially taking an exact copy of the genes, if mutations appear because of the many ways, you know, the sun's rays, for example, or environmental toxins, whatever, if those mutations stay, there's no way of shuffling them out because you're getting an exact copy. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah. And one problem is that, sure, there are some mutations that might make it impossible to survive, but there are a lot more mutations that are more like death by a thousand cuts, where they do something that's just a little tiny bit bad. And the problem is that under asexual reproduction, what's expected is that you should keep getting more and more of these. There's no good way to get rid of them until there's so many that the species goes extinct.
Right. Muller's ratchet. I hadn't heard that idea before, but that makes total sense. So
yeah.
The Amazon Molly is a fish that doesn't engage in sexual reproduction. It has somehow figured out how to essentially clone itself. Can you tell me a little bit more about this fish and how it reproduces?
Sure. So Amazon mollies, they're an all-female species. They're only female fish. And they all give live birth to clones of themselves. So the offspring don't have any DNA from another parent. They are exact copies of the mother.
Don't reproduce themselves. You need these fish haven't evolved for female-female reproduction. That doesn't make any sense, right?
Sure. They haven't evolved for female-female reproduction, but they do make exact copies of themselves. In a strange twist, they actually still need to be fertilized by sperm. So they still need to mate with a male, but there are no males in the species. So they have to mate with a fish from a different species in order to reproduce. But then the DNA from the sperm fertilizes the egg and triggers it to start growing, but the DNA doesn't actually end up in the egg. And so you end up with offspring that, even though it results from a mating between a male and a female, is an exact copy of the female with no contribution from the male.
That is crazy. So
it really is.
The species wouldn't be able to interbreed anyway for the most part, but it depends on the sort of triggering of the fertilization process from an external male.
Exactly.
But then just says, I don't need any of your DNA from the sperm. Thank you very much. You've just started the process. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Exactly.
Okay. So that is very unusual, right? Do we know of any other species that does this?
I'm not sure. There are about 100 species of vertebrates specifically that we know of that reproduce exclusively asexually. There are a lot more that can kind of reproduce asexually sometimes, but they still have a way to reproduce sexually. Yeah.
They change sexes, some of them, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are all sorts of different ways that animals can engage in reproduction. As for the question of specifically whether other of these asexual animals need sperm to reproduce, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, that's really crazy. I'm a bit of a bummer for the male fish that I've found this, you know, these Amazons, these fully female species, and it can't infiltrate their DNA. So that's they take part in the mating process, but for no reason. So it's completely wasted.
Yeah, some people go as far as to call it a parasitic relationship, because the males still have to go to the trouble of mating with the female, but then they don't get anything out of it evolutionarily. Right.
How did these fish become asexual then? How did that happen in the first place?
So how they started out is they started with hybridization between two different species that live in the same place. So these two different species of fish, they're somewhat related. They're in the same genus. So it's not like a cat and a dog or something, but they're somewhat related, but not super related. They mated and they created an offspring. And these two species have mated and created offspring plenty of times before that and after that. But what normally happens when two species mate and create an offspring is either they can reproduce just fine or they can't reproduce at all. And I think good examples of this, for being able to reproduce just fine, you can think of modern humans and Neanderthals, where these were two different populations that were able to admix such that today, many tens of thousands of years later, we mostly do still have Neanderthal ancestry from those hybridization events. Whereas an example of a hybridization that didn't work out so well would be a mule, which is a cross of a donkey and a horse. And a mule is not able to reproduce at all. It's a dead end in as far as evolution goes. But the third possibility, and this is what happened with Amazon Mali, and this is very rare, is that it was able to still reproduce, but one small part of its reproductive process was broken. And this is the part where it is able to divide its genes into two different pieces so that you end up with two half copies of the genome in each egg that then get fertilized by sperm, so that you end up with new organisms that are half the mother's genome and half the father's genome.
Right.
It lost that ability, but retained everything else.
Wait a second. What about Mueller's ratchet, though? Because if they're not taking any DNA and they're not shuffling the cards, how do they avoid accumulating a million bad genes that eventually lead to an unviable species?
So that is the big question that motivated our research into this topic. Because for about 100 years, it's been kind of generally accepted that if you look at the math, if you do the calculations, it shouldn't work. You shouldn't be able to be asexual and only asexual for long periods of time. But these fish have been reproducing asexually exclusively for at least 100,000 years.
That's what the genes tell us.
Mm-hmm. And so it's this big question where we've known about these fish as scientists. It was first discovered that these fish reproduce asexually about 100 years ago. They were the first vertebrate that scientists found to be asexually reproducing. And so you have these two different lines of thought. One says, well, the math says that this should not be possible. But then the other says, well, we're looking at these fish, and it is. And so how is it that they're doing that?
Are you going to tell me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yes. Good.
So what we discovered is that how they're getting around this is they're using a process called gene conversion. And so gene conversion is a phenomenon that happens in all sorts of cells. It happens in humans. It happens in other animals. It's not exclusive to Amazon mollies, but it is a process where we all have two copies of our genome, right? One from our mother and one from our father. And normally you think of these as being fixed within one individual. And then when you create offspring, they get one copy of each of those from you and one from the other parent. But in gene conversion, something a little bit different happens. So you might start out with two different versions of a gene in a certain place, but then gene conversion causes one of these versions to overwrite the other version. And we've known that this happens in lots of different contexts across the tree of life. And so it's been hypothesized before that maybe this is the secret to how Amazon mollies and other asexual organisms are able to get around Muller's ratchet. And
just to be clear, what you're suggesting is that that they have sort of a blueprint for the genome that's sort of stored away. And then if there's an error in the gene, they just go back to the blueprint and say, no, that shouldn't be like that. We'll just copy over the gene the way it should be. Like you're talking about, it's almost a CRISPR-Cas9 toolkit within a species where they can just select these genes aren't the ones we want and copy over inside itself. I mean, how does it do that?
So it is a mechanism that it can happen different ways, but often the places that you see it happening are the places where DNA is likely to get damaged. And so it is often a repair mechanism. And again, right. This is not limited to asexual species. This is, you know, it can happen in one of your cells when your cell is copying. And again, we all have two copies of all of our genes. So sometimes one of them gets damaged. One of them, the DNA just breaks. Maybe it's when it's getting copied, maybe in another scenario. But the way that the cellular machinery can repair this, if a piece of the DNA is missing, is to, exactly as you said, use the other copy as a blueprint to fill in the gap.
Does that mean that then these Amazon mollies are complete and exact clones of an original Amazon molly at one point in time?
Almost. So it means that except for gene conversion and mutations, they are copies of one original Amazon molly.
Right. So how does the, we're implying consciousness here, so excuse my wording, but how does the system know which genes to fix so that they don't damage the overall genome? I mean, you said it's where DNA breaks, but there are also some genes that wouldn't necessarily be break or necessarily, inverted commas, damaged, but they could make it more susceptible to a certain disease or lead to a process within cells that meant it couldn't clear out, you know, used materials and so on. There's lots of different things that go on in a cell that the cell itself wouldn't know, well, this is a bad gene. How does it know which genes to replace?
So, yeah, it's can be really difficult to talk about evolution without veering into using language that suggests there's some sort of consciousness behind it that knows what it's doing. And so often even evolutionary biologists resort to using this kind of language, and that's fine, as long as you remember that at the end of the day, it's really a random process going on. And so in this case, the gene conversion is doing the same thing. It happens in random places, and maybe it happens in a place that is doing something helpful, and maybe it happens in a place that's doing something not helpful. Most of the time, it's going to be happening in a place that does something neutral. It's not good. It's not bad. But what this does is, by happening a bunch of times over these many generations in random places, then this gives natural selection something to work with that it didn't have to work with before. Before, without gene conversion, natural selection only has the diversity created by mutations to work with. And so it can either just reject an entire lineage because the mutational load is bad or something, or it can promote an entire lineage, but it can't act on individual pieces of the genome the way that it can with sexual reproduction.
Right.
But what gene conversion is doing is it's giving it different options to choose from.
Okay, so it's like it's an equivalent of natural selection, except a different process. It gives the genome things to try out and be successful. And some of those may lead to an unhealthy fish that doesn't reproduce. And some may lead to it being successful. But then the offspring of that Amazon molly will then be a different, genetically slightly different.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right.
And so, in essence, this is a way of, it can, when it does this gene conversion and it happens to overwrite a mutation that is deleterious to the organism, then natural selection can take advantage of that and say, hey, this is good. It has gotten rid of a mutation that is bad for it. And so this one is the one that's going to get selected.
Do we know that if the mechanism of ejecting the sperm of the male fish that tries to mate with the Amazon Molly and the Molly just rejects all of the DNA, do we know if that DNA was actually introduced to the egg that they would actually be able to reproduce, or is that just completely impossible? Is the mating part just completely irrelevant?
So that's a great question, and I'm not sure that there really is a good answer to that yet. But what seems to have happened is that the reason that they still need the sperm despite not reproducing sexually appears to be that something about their sexual reproduction was broken a little bit. And it wasn't broken so much that it made them completely incapable of reproducing. And it wasn't so broken that it turned them into a clonal organism that could just, without any sperm or anything, reproduce.
Right.
So it's more like it messed up this one little piece, but everything else is in place. And so it still needs sperm. Something about what the sperm fertilizing the egg signals to the egg allows it to keep growing.
Why would it do this, right? Why? It sounds so much more complicated, and natural selection is already right there. Sexual reproduction is already right there. Why did the Amazon Molly decide that they were going to be asexual?
Just an accident. No decision to it. Just like almost everything in evolution, it is just an accident that has happened to work out over the long term.
Are there any uses of this mechanism, this genetic copying, that we might be able to use in medicine?
I'm not sure. I think that certainly what I can say for sure is that any ability to better understand how mutation works and how the genome functions in all sorts of different contexts, whether it's in reproduction, whether it's in cancer, just learning more about the basic biology of DNA and of genomes is going to be helpful to us in lots of ways that we probably can't even imagine just yet.
Mm. We didn't actually cover why it's called the Amazon Molly. We should probably finish with that. Why is it called the Amazon Molly? Is it found in the Amazon?
It is not. So actually, the reason that it's called the Amazon Molly, it actually lives in Mexico and Texas in the Rio Grande watershed. And it's called the Amazon Molly because they're all females. And so this is after the Greek mythology of the Amazon warriors, this society of all female warriors.
How did these fish become asexual then? How did that happen in the first place?
So how they started out is they started with hybridization between two different species that live in the same place. So these two different species of fish, they're somewhat related. They're in the same genus. So it's not like a cat and a dog or something, but they're somewhat related, but not super related. They mated and they created an offspring. And these two species have mated and created offspring plenty of times before that and after that. But what normally happens when two species mate and create an offspring is either they can reproduce just fine or they can't reproduce at all. And I think good examples of this, for being able to reproduce just fine, you can think of modern humans and Neanderthals, where these were two different populations that were able to admix such that today, many tens of thousands of years later, we mostly do still have Neanderthal ancestry from those hybridization events. Whereas an example of a hybridization that didn't work out so well would be a mule, which is a cross of a donkey and a horse. And a mule is not able to reproduce at all. It's a dead end in as far as evolution goes. But the third possibility, and this is what happened with Amazon Molly, and this is very rare, is that it was able to still reproduce, but one small part of its reproductive process was broken. And this is the part where it is able to divide its genes into two different pieces so that you end up with two half copies of the genome. in each egg that then get fertilized by sperm, so that you end up with new organisms that are half the mother's genome and half the father's genome.
Right.
It lost that ability, but retained everything else.
Really fascinating animal, and so lovely to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time. Ed Reismeier is at the Ludwig Maximilians Universität in Munich. Thanks so much, Ed.
Yes, thank you. It was great to talk to you.
Obviously, I don't think I would want a world entirely without males, but a world run by females, I think, would be a better thing. Most of my political idols are women, AOC, Angela Merkel, Mary Robinson. Some of my best friends, actually, are some of my idols. But we just can't have that, can we? Just the way the world is. Maybe in 100,000 years, we'll have figured out a way. But right now, the future looks pretty bleak. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Goffin on podcast, Stephen McLean on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.